Welcome, everyone. My name is Nihal Bujale. I was the panel captain for this panel on the future of large-scale digital experiments. I'd like you to introduce you to our moderator, Professor Sinan Aral. Sinan, please.
Thanks, everybody. Can everybody hear me okay? You okay? Yeah. Testing, testing.
Yeah.
All better? Okay. My name is Sinan Aral. I'm a professor at the Sloan School here and part of the initiative on the digital economy. And I wanted to, before I introduce everyone on the panel, I wanted to let you know that we had one unfortunate cancellation. Zeynep Ton couldn't be with us today because she is in bed with a serious virus. So she couldn't really move, and so we told her to just take care of herself. But she sends her regrets and her apologies, and so we wished her well. And Derek Rose is likely to be here just a little bit late, so he might come in while we're talking. I'll introduce him as if he's here, and then he'll get all the credit without any of the hard work. Let me just sort of give you a sense for the purpose of this panel. And this might be David. Hello. Hey, how are you? We're on the third floor of the Student Union next to Kresge. Are you... Oh, okay. Great. Okay, so we're starting the panel now. So just, I'll introduce you and just slip in and, yeah, we'll put you on speaker. third floor of the Student Union. Exactly. Okay, bye. Okay, that was him. So he should be here. I'll introduce him as if he's here, and then we'll make him do all the hard work when he gets here. Okay, so let me just give you a quick sense for why we're having this panel, and then introduce everybody and get started with the discussion. So it has come to our attention in the last 5 years or so that obviously big data is a buzzword that's sort of hovering around pretty much everything that's going on in academia and industry. And that's a nice buzzword. We certainly have a lot of data. But one of the most radical innovations that exists today in business analytics or in social science and academic research is, as a consequence of this big data buzz, flying under the radar is big experimentation. And the reason why this is so interesting to us is that we sort of now have an unprecedented ability to randomize and experiment with extremely realistic and complex social systems. Okay, so for example, personally, I have collaborated on projects where we have tested things like personalized social advertising on Facebook on 250 million people. Okay, so randomized A/B and multivariate testing on 250 million people simultaneously is sort of the new reality of experimentation. We've worked with Yahoo, Nike, The New York Times, Facebook, as I mentioned, and so on, to do regularly experiments with 10 million, 50 million, or 100 million people at a time. And this type of experimentation really has a tremendous impact on what we can learn and what we can know. Because if you do experiments in a lab where you, at some unnamed New England university, and you bring in students into the lab and you do an experiment, you can do a nice randomization, but typically you have some problems with generalization. So how well do these students represent the real world out there? Or, you know, what is the distribution of treatment effects rather than just the average treatment effect? When you have 100 million people in an experiment, you can say, well, how do women react differently to this treatment than men? Or how do people under the age of 30 react differently than people over the age of 50? And you have enough statistical power to estimate those types of things. When you have an experiment with a couple of hundred people, you can really only estimate the average treatment effect. In addition, you can now do these in vivo field experiments where really you are capturing the essence of people behaving in their real-life digital or physical environments, something that's not sort of stylized in a lab, but something that's real in the real world. And this has, I think, tremendous implications for business analytics. You know, Google is running approximately, give or take, 1,000 experiments at any given moment. And so you're probably in several different experiments at any given time while you're visiting any Google website. Same is true for a lot of other websites. And what you can learn from this type of experimentation is that you can sort of get causal inference. You can understand how moving one feature or variable or element of the social system creates different outcomes for different parts of the social system. So to make a long story short, I feel like we're on the brink of a revolution in our understanding of human behavior at population scale as a result of digital experimentation. So what we've tried to do is we have tried to assemble a series of experts that really are sort of incredibly knowledgeable, both from the academic side and the business side, for what it means to be able to do these kinds of experiments. What is the blocking of tackling of doing them? What are some of the costs and benefits, the challenges, and so on? And there are lots of challenges that we're going to go through and lots of potential opportunities as well. So that's sort of the goal of the session today. And with that, let me introduce our panelists and get right into it. So immediately to my left is Kareem Lakhani. He's a professor at Harvard Business School, and in particular, he's principal investigator of the Crowd Innovation Labs and NASA Tournament Lab at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard. Kareem really has been one of the primary global leaders of research on distributed innovation systems, open source software, and most recently, innovation contests. He's doing some of the most interesting experimental work on how innovation happens in open structures, in team-based environments or contexts, as well as how competition inspires innovation. So he's doing these types of field experiments on behavior in contests and scientific team formation at places like Topcoder and Harvard Medical School, and he'll describe a little bit of that. To his left is Narinder Singh. He's the president of Topcoder, and he's on the board of directors of Aperio. He's a co-founder of Aperio, which is a company that's at the forefront of cloud, social, and mobile technologies. Prior to that, he worked at SAP in the office of the CEO as part of the corporate strategy group. He's worked at several nonprofits on their development, and he supports a number of their causes, including the Miracle Foundation and Architecture for Humanity. And in particular, he has a really broad view of the applications of experimentation for business, but also for larger societal issues like education, health, development. And he's going to sort of bring a sort of applied practice perspective today. I do want to mention Zeynep, who couldn't be with us. She is really a phenomenal researcher who looks at how you can design and manage operations around HR, something that satisfies employees and investors simultaneously. So she's written a book called The Good Job Strategy, and it's really about how designing good jobs for employees is important for productivity. And so I will channel for her her thoughts on how you can do experimentation right. Because when you do it wrong, employees in large organizations can become sort of guinea pigs, and that's one thing that you want to avoid if you're trying to establish a good job strategy. So if you'll permit me, I'll try to channel her perspective on the panel today. And finally, walking over here as we speak is David Rose. He's the CEO of Ditto Labs. He's a serial entrepreneur. He's been working on online photo sharing, wireless glanceable displays, solving the adherence problem in the pharmaceutical industry. He's a visiting scientist at the MIT Media Lab. And most recently, he's written an awesome book called Enchanted Objects, which goes beyond the Internet of Things to talk about what John Seely Brown described as the medium designed for pre-attentive cognition, conveying information, and subliminally and delightfully communicating with our objects. And it's gotten just some amazing praise from people like Brad Feld, who called it spectacular, and John Seely Brown. Really sort of what happens when everything in your home becomes smart and can connect with you and talk to you and order milk for you while you're out and so on and so forth. So he'll be joining us in just a minute. So what I want to do is I want to start off with Kareem and just ask you to describe a little bit, some of the work that you've been doing on platforms like Topcoder and at NASA and at the Harvard Medical School, and really ask you what you think are the benefits to business analytics and also to social science in general from large-scale experimentation in your experience.
Thanks, Adan. Thanks for the invitation. So I think, first, I mean, if you're a CIO or if you have an online business or a major online component, if you're not doing experimentation, you're leaving gobs of money on the table. And probably most of the analysis you're doing is probably going to be wrong. Right? So if you have a website, you have online data, and you're doing any kind of an analysis, most likely the analysis you're going to be doing is wrong. And the reason why it is that we spend, as academics, spend a lot of time thinking about, and lots of training, thinking about causality. And the reality is that most of the models you're running, predicting a customer coming back, predicting a customer action, or some other behavior, most of the analysis you're doing is going to be wrong because the regression models have assumptions about them that are always being violated. So I spent some time. Some of my former students, you know, are at major online platforms, and they show me their analysis, and I go, "This is obviously wrong, right? Like you're getting the wrong inference." And so that's a big danger because what's happened in the world is that people like Sinan and I would spend years getting trained in econometric methods and experimentation. And if you would get, 10,000 subjects observed over 5 months on a weekly basis, that's like a serious data set, right? And then we would have a doctoral student and maybe a postdoc, and we would spend 6 months, 9 months figuring out how to analyze the data and then running the right regressions. Today, you have a website, your miner hit on a website, you have the same data, but you don't have the analytical toolkit to be able to answer the right questions. And so to get around this trap of wrong analysis based on observed data, you have to then move to an experimentation paradigm. And if you're not moving to that paradigm, you're not thinking through it seriously, then again, I think there's serious gobs of money that you're sort of leaving behind. And the thing to remember is that experimentation is nothing new, right? So this was invented in the Enlightenment, right? And in the 17th century, right? When we went from a religious view to a natural philosophical view of the world, right? The people in Europe basically invented experimentation. And the thing about experimentation is you have treatment and you have control, right? You need a control and you need treatment, right? Basic stuff you learned in biology, right, or physics in high school, but that gets forgotten. In the business world, we just say, "Oh, I'm experimenting," which means I'm trying different things. I'm tinkering. Tinkering is different from experimentation. It gets conflated. Experimentation is you have a hypothesis. You think that some action is happening in your population or your customer base or your employee base, or supplier base, and that if you create a treatment around that action, right, you will see some results. But then you need a control. You need to compare that treatment with a control group and then see if that is purely the effect of the treatment or some other variable going on. And that simplistic perspective is often ignored in most business settings.
I remember a statistic, and I'm going to get the numbers maybe just a tiny bit wrong, but the order of magnitude is right, that there was a meta study done of experimental and non-experimental work that found that 90% of the experimental studies that were analyzed were able to be replicated, and something like 15 to 20% of the non-experimental results were replicable. And that's what Kareem is talking about in terms of getting it wrong when you're not running an experiment.
There's some other work, a colleague of mine at HBS looked at 1,000 factories and what was causing factories to make changes. So managers running plants and then deciding to make some change. And 95% of the changes were due to noise. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anything systematic going on. They saw a change and thought, oh, it must be some kind of a causal thing going on because their analysis was wrong. And so I wanted to set this up that it's a huge opportunity for CIOs, for people that are dealing on the front end or the back end of the digital economy to start to tool up an experimentation mindset and approach within your organization and to bring up. My own work, I study innovation, primarily study problem solving, how people engage in problem solving in the institutions of other communities, so open source software or contests. And I've been very fortunate to have a very good relationship with Top Coder, where we work closely with people from NASA, people from medical school. We take real problems,
So for example, get a problem from the space station on how to best optimize the solar panels on the space station to maximize the power output. And so we would run a contest on the TopCoder platform, and then I would change incentives, I would change information, I might change teaming, so I can then come back and both solve the problem for NASA. We get thousands of people competing on our problems for NASA or the medical school, but at the same time, I can now say with confidence that potentially, like, when you double incentives, this is the behavioral response we expect from these types of people.
So what type of specific takeaways can NASA take, for instance, that they can then implement to get some benefit from the results?
So for NASA, what's interesting is NASA cares about getting the problem solved, right? So they may not even care about the black box that the TopCoder is running, right? But so for NASA, it's a great cheap way for them to get robust algorithms developed. And we've now run over 700 challenges of all types for NASA. At the same time, they want to scale up their capability of how to use these online platforms for their own work. And so now we can give them advice on, for these types of problems, you should be running a contest of this type. For these types of problems, you might want to change the prize structure, right? Or you might want to go for a team structure instead of an individual basis.
Okay.
So we can get, and again, the problem in most innovation research is endogeneity, right? We just don't know if X leads to Y or Y leads to X. And so we can now come in and, in fact, provide very specific causal advice that X definitely leads to Y under these circumstances, and that goes a long way.
Mm-hmm. Does NASA have a control ISS somewhere like orbiting?
Exactly. That's a great, it's simulated. Right.
So I wanted to bring David in, and it seems to me that one roadblock to unleashing the power of experimentation is, you know, if we keep focusing just on clicks, like I can run a digital experiment where I am, you know, changing something on Facebook and seeing how many people click through, or I can run a digital experiment where, you know, I change the incentive structure and people are turning in software code, and then But it seems like we want to be able to understand things that are more costly behaviors or more physically sort of in the real world. And at the same time that we have this trend towards large-scale experimentation and figuring out the science behind that, we have this sort of complementary trend of the Internet of Things and enchanted objects, where all of the devices around us are becoming smarter, all of the devices around us are becoming internet-enabled, which seems to give us some sort of a pathway to move experimentation off the digital substrate into the physical world and start to expand the scope. So I wonder if you could tell us, so I did introduce you and talked a little bit about the book, and so now we're gonna ask you to talk a little bit about, you know, the Internet of Things and enchanted objects. What are the meaningful elements of that trend today, and how do they relate to experimentation?
Thanks, Anand. Sorry for being late. I've been interested in internet-connected objects since working for LEGO back about 20 years ago on LEGO Mindstorms, which was a project that you probably all grew up with, a way to embed a little bit of sensing and a little bit of computation in ordinary LEGO bricks so that people could build contraptions that they could imagine the behavior of and then build those behaviors. But I do think experimentally we have so many more sensors in the world that we can start to gather data in many, many new ways about people's everyday behaviors. I've just started wearing the Apple Watch and sort of disappointing, but I feel like one of the promises of this is health kits, the sort of the ability to have access to the sort of open data from wearables that hopefully millions. Apple hopes millions of you will adopt this sort of device. And I'm especially interested in the sort of indigenous business models to changing people's behavior that are getting subsidization happening for things like Fitbits and Jawbone Ups. And, you know, these things are being paid for by your employer, paid for by your health plan. And then so it gets much easier to roll these things out because they don't cost us anything. They just become standard wear. I did this, you may have heard of the in medication packaging that I did a couple of years ago, just happened to have one because of this talk, which is a cap that's internet connected that goes on standard medication vials, and it will, you know, it has like a little OnStar button, a little push to refill button, and we'll text you so you don't forget, and we'll send email to a loved one as just, and
so you really don't forget.
so you're motivated to do the right thing. But you know, the vision for this was to make this standard medication packaging so that nobody would have to pay for this. It would just be given to you by the pharma companies because they'd sell 30% more med, and paid for by the healthcare company because they would save, hopefully, you know, somebody counted as $300 billion in unnecessary hospitalizations in the US because people don't take their meds. I've been, over the last 2 years, I've been working on an image recognition startup called Ditto Labs, mostly because the types of sensors that you're able to embed in these ordinary objects are becoming more and more powerful, right? Like the GloCap just knew if it was opened. It didn't even know whether you actually took a pill out. But now we're putting cameras in the tips of our pens, like the Enoto pen to know what you've written, or in the paintbrush, like a Media Lab prototype that we did was called the IO brush. So you'd sort of sample the world. You'd say, I want that color, or I want that pattern. And then you'd paint with that pattern because it had a little camera at the tip of the brush. In the same way, I think we're taping cameras like Dropcam into more places in our lives. One of the projects from the Media Lab also was a smile meter. It was like a mood meter that was deployed around campus. And you could see what was the mood of the place as shown by blob detection to find people, face detection to find the faces, and then smile detection to find, are people smiling in this place on campus? And it does change throughout the year based on exam times. You do have people frowning and like walking past each other and not greeting each other. But I've been wearing this device called the narrative clip for the last year or so. And every 30 seconds that I'm wearing it, it takes a photo. Right? So it's sort of interesting as a, you know, it's a life logging camera. Sorry, I didn't ask your permission to wear it this morning. But the little flipbooks of your day gather a lot of data. And these are being given out by, we have a customer that's working with J&J, another one working with Unilever, another one working with P&G. And they're having people wear these things around saying like, well, you're a new dad. Let's see what you do. And so they pay you to wear this for a few days. And you can see how often do people use products, how often do people, like how many diapers did he actually change? how often is he outside? How often is he inside? The expressions of people around him. But mostly for J&J, they really want to know which products and how often and how are you using those products.
So just two quick questions about that. So it seems like we are now able to document digitally, quantitatively, but also in places that we weren't able to document before, the lives that people are living. So the questions are, A, how does this, what does this mean for experimentation in terms of our ability to experiment in new settings or our ability to experiment through these sensors? And B, is there some sort of a Hawthorne effect? Do people behave differently when, does the dad change more diapers during the day because he knows that the thing is taking pictures every 30 seconds?
I'm sure as I walk around with this camera, if people know about it, they do tend to like look down at it and like either give me the finger or smile or something more often because, but I think what documentary filmmakers know is that over time, the Hawthorne effect loses its power, mm-hmm. and people go back to being normal.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the power of your Fitbit sort of attenuates over time.
And the role for experimentation?
I think, as you said, you just have better tools for documentation, and mm-hmm. that allows you to sense in a more fine-grained way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know that there are studies being done where cell phones are instrumented, or whole communities are given a cell phone, and then elements of the cell phone's infrastructure are randomized in order to sort of see what small nudges of behavior can do to entire communities in terms of health outcomes or time spent with your family and things like that. So one thing that I was hoping that Zeynep could bring to this conversation, I'll try to channel a little bit her good jobs thinking, is that In one sense, when I put my academic hat on, this all sounds incredibly useful and tremendously helpful both for businesses and for science. But it also sounds a little creepy, right? I mean, there are elements of this that evoke not only Big Brother, but also, you know, hyper-optimization, George Orwell-type scenario where every employee is instrumented with a camera, every, email swipe is logged, and then, we're going to randomize your pay and see how much more you produce in terms of, like, output per unit time. And then we're going to, if you happen to succeed at this experiment, we're going to give you a raise, and if you fail, we're going to fire you. And, so none of that sounds like a good job strategy to me. And when I asked Zeynep about this, she said that she wasn't anti-experimentation, but she said that experimentation had to be done right, in the sense that when you are looking for the causal relationship between X and Y, it's this very small, narrow question that you're asking. But really, productivity is a holistic sum of parts, that essentially, HR planning and strategy isn't about optimizing the number of keystrokes on an email, but it's about sort of a more complementarity between groups of activities that provide both people being satisfied with their jobs and increased productivity. So I wanted to turn to Narinder for a couple of reasons. First, you and I had a nice conversation about an experience you had where this was done in your workplace. There was an experiment done in your workplace, and I wanted to get sort of a firsthand account from you about what that felt like and what the culture, how the culture responded to this experiment. But then after you sort of described that a little bit, I wanted to sort of ask you to think about the applications of large-scale experimentation, that hold the most promise, not just for industry, but also for society at large. Can we think, beyond sort of, maximizing clicks or maximizing productivity?
So first thing, how many people here work at a company whose goal, I'm not saying they do, whose goal is to make money? That's about half, right? And if you raise your hand and you're at educational university, then that's a whole other problem. Me too. So I'm with you on that. And I would venture to guess that as you listen to especially Sinan and Kareem talk at the beginning, there's probably a couple words they use that you didn't understand, right? And it becomes like, wow, is this what I'm going to have to go through to actually make this happen? And I think there's an argument to be made that the key to large-scale digital experiments, which I think are really critical, is starting with a small-scale one, right, and how to do that. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. In my preparation for this panel, I started, because I was like, I'm going to be on a panel with two world-renowned professors. What do I do? So 11 years ago, I married somebody who one day became a professor. So if you can't do that, there are still some techniques to translate through.
She runs experiments.
Yes. It actually happens if we went on randomizing pay in villages in India, but we won't go there. So it's interesting, but it's, seriously, like I'm on a panel with Kareem, who knows more about TopCoder than probably I do, right? And I'm supposedly running that area. So it's the question of how do you actually engage in this way? And so I think there's different flavors of experiments and what you're trying to achieve with them. The first thing around TopCoder, and Kareem will hit this a lot later, is there we are trying to optimize and really, he's trying to understand the why, and we're trying to make it better, right? So his understanding that the researchers are looking for is much more fine-grained than what we are, but we certainly benefit from that fine-grained understanding of better and worse, right? And this is a transition to what you were asking. So Aperio, the company that operates TopCoder, we're about 1,200 people. And so we're all about running challenges and seeing what would happen, and we have a pretty big fitness culture. So a few years ago, about 3 years ago, we essentially negotiated with our insurance provider to allow us to basically give us an incentive to set up a fitness program that was centered around giving everybody a Fitbit who wanted one. And that's a key closing statement, who wanted one. We didn't say, you will wear a Fitbit every day, everyone. So it was opt-in, and basically what we started to do is collect data around that, and we could show that there was an overall level of activity that had risen. Now, we didn't know why, which one of the six things we did was related to that, but we actually were able to have data that allowed us to actually negotiate with our insurance company as they were looking at raising our rates, because that's what insurance companies do. We were able to actually have a data-centric conversation on how our fitness and wellness programs were affecting employees.